From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Humorist David Sedaris is back on the bestseller list with the new paperback edition of his book, Me Talk Pretty One Day. On today's Fresh Air, Sedaris reads from the book and tells us some stories about his failed music lessons, his misadventures as a performance artist, and his new life as an American in Paris. Also, we talk with actor Alan Cumming. He aroused women and men in the Broadway revival of Cabaret, playing a sexed-up version of the MC, the role originated by Joel Grey. Alan Cumming co-wrote and co-directed the new film, The Anniversary Party, with his co-star, Jennifer Jason Leigh. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Swordfish, starring John Travolta. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal appeals panel in Philadelphia has ruled that the execution of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh may not be videotaped for use in an unrelated death penalty case. The three-judge panel overruled a lower court that said the execution could be videotaped after McVeigh had given his permission. Attorneys in a separate death penalty case had wanted to use the videotape in an effort to demonstrate that the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment. The Justice Department strongly opposed the videotaping, saying it would violate federal regulations. McVeigh is scheduled to die by injection on Monday morning at a federal penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. A federal jury in Miami has convicted five Cubans of spying against the United States. The five were also found guilty of involvement in the fatal 1996 shootdown of two private American planes by a Cuban fighter jet. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
U.S. prosecutors presented thousands of pages of decrypted documents confiscated from the five men, all of whom were agents of the Cuban government. Though both sides agreed that the group never obtained any classified information, the documents did show that the group tried to infiltrate U.S. military bases in Florida, as well as anti-Castro Cuban groups in Miami. One of those was Brothers to the Rescue, a group of pilots that rescued Cubans fleeing Cuba by sea, and which was also notorious for dropping anti-Castro pamphlets over Havana. Using information from its informants, Cuba shot down and killed four Brothers to the Rescue members who flew near Cuban airspace in 1996. The trial lasted nearly 6 months. It took the jury 5 days to reach a verdict. The men now face between 10 years and life in prison. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
The Congressional Budget Office has raised its estimates of the cost of adding a prescription drug benefit to Medicare, but not by as much as many lawmakers had feared. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
This spring, Congress set aside $300 billion for a Medicare drug benefit. Today, Congress's official scorekeeper said some of the leading proposals from last year would meet or only slightly exceed that amount. According to CBO, the plan backed by Senate Democrats would cost $318 billion between now and 2011. A less generous bill crafted by Republican Senator Bill Frist of Tennessee and Democrat John Breaux of Louisiana would cost $176 billion. Lawmakers said the new numbers make it more likely Congress can agree on a drug benefit. But all the proposals would be more expensive than they appear. That's because CBO assumes no program could start until 2004, so the 10-year estimates only include 7 years of benefits. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 113 points, or 1%. The Nasdaq lost 49 points, or 2%. This is NPR News. The Miami relatives of Elian Gonzalez are now free to sue the federal government for the raid that took the young Cuban shipwreck survivor from their home. A federal judge in Miami said the boy's uncle, Lazaro Gonzalez, his wife and daughter, have alleged enough facts to back up their claim that government agents used excessive force and violated their constitutional rights. The daughters of boxing legends Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier will fight tonight in upstate New York. The highly publicized event has angered some who believe it'll demean the great Ali-Frazier fights of the 1970s. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Three ferocious fights between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier became part of sports legend, not just because of the boxing, but also because of the boxers' different personalities. Ali was glamorous and outrageous and often taunted the much quieter Frazier. Now their bitter rivalry is having a renaissance of sorts with tonight's fight between the daughters. But many critics say the fight, dubbed Ali-Frazier 4, is an insult to the original battles. Former boxing reporter Larry Merchant calls it a carnival act and not representative of serious female boxing. 23-year-old Layla Ali has fought only 9 times. 39-year-old Jackie Frazier lied 7 times. Still, the fight has generated interest. 300 media credentials were issued, and enough people have bought tickets or pay-per-view television to guarantee at least $100,000 to each fighter. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
People in southern Louisiana and southeast Texas are bracing for another night of drenching rains and flooding. The remnant of Tropical Storm Allison has been pouring rain on the region since Tuesday. Some parts of Louisiana have gotten almost 2 feet of rain over the past 4 days. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Sedaris has developed a passionate following for his funny autobiographical essays and his terrific readings. Sedaris is now a regular contributor to the public radio program This American Life. He's back on the bestseller list with the new paperback edition of his book, Me Talk Pretty One Day. Director Wayne Wong is adapting the book into a film with Matthew Broderick slated to star as Sedaris. Me Talk Pretty One Day includes several pieces about Sedaris's recent move to France, where he's been struggling to learn the language. The book is dedicated to his father, about whom David says, "You wouldn't seek him out for advice on a personal problem, but he'd be the first one you'd call when the dishwasher broke or someone flushed a hairpiece down your toilet." David's father was also a jazz fan, and he encouraged his kids to take music lessons. Although David's only music ambition was to be a song stylist like Billie Holiday, he briefly took guitar lessons from a midget named Mr. Mancini. Here's a reading about that from the interview we recorded last year when the book was published in hardcover.
My voice shaking, I told him that I had absolutely no interest in mastering the guitar. What I really wanted was to sing in the voice of Billie Holiday. Mainly commercials, but not for banks or car dealerships, because those are usually choral arrangements. The color ebbed from my teacher's face. I told him I'd been working up an act and could use a little accompaniment. Did he know the jingle for the new Sara Lee campaign? You want me to do what? He wasn't angry, just confused. I felt certain he was lying when he denied knowing the tune. Double Mint Gum, Ritz Crackers, the theme songs for Alka-Seltzer and Kenmore Appliances. He claimed ignorance on all counts. I knew that it was queer to sing in front of someone, but greater than my discomfort was the hope that he might recognize what I thought of as my great talent, the one musical trick I was able to pull off. I started in on an a cappella version of the latest Oscar Mayer commercial, hoping he might join in once the spirit moved him. It looked bad, I knew, but in order to sustain the proper mood, I needed to disregard his company and sing the way I did at home alone in my bedroom, my eyes shut tight and my hands dangling like pointless, empty gloves. I sang that my baloney had a first name. I added that my baloney had a second name and concluded with, "Oh, I love to eat it every day. And if you ask me why, I'll say that Oscar Mayer has a way with B-O-L-O-G-N-A. I reached the end of my tune, thinking he might take this as an opportunity to applaud or maybe even apologize for underestimating me. Mild amusement might have been an appropriate response, but instead he held up his hands as if to stop an advancing car. "Hey, guy," he said, "you can hold it right there. I'm not into that scene." A scene? What scene? I thought I was being original. "There were plenty of screwballs like you back in Atlanta," he said. "But me, I don't swing that way. You got it? This might be your thing or whatever, but you can definitely count me out." He reached for his conch shell and stubbed out his cigarette. "I mean, come on now. For God's sakes, kid, pull yourself together." I knew then why I'd never sung in front of anyone, and why I shouldn't have done it in front of Mr. Mancini. He'd used the word screwball, but I knew what he really meant. He meant I should have named my guitar Doug or Brian, or better yet, taken up the flute. He meant that if we're defined by our desires, I was in for a lifetime of trouble.
And that's David Sedaris reading from his new collection, Me Talk Pretty One Day. David, you know, I love that story, and I had to have you read it so that you could do your Billie Holiday thing. You know, reading that made me wonder if there was a lot you had to hide as a kid because you were gay and it wasn't a good thing to let people know that.
Well, it was pretty much the last thing that you wanted to be if you were, I don't know, growing up that time in North Carolina, or maybe it's still that way for kids growing up today, is that you just think it'll change tomorrow. I'm just this way today, but tomorrow it will change, and that it has to be your secret. But what's so funny is then you look back and you see in family photographs, or I should have just had the word queen tattooed on my forehead. I wasn't fooling anybody. You don't wear your mother's pantyhose and think that your parents are going to mistake you for a heterosexual. But at that time, you think, oh, I'm clever, and that they'll never know.
So did cover-ups and lying become necessary and commonplace in your life when you were young?
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, you had to hide what it was that you were really doing and what you were really thinking. But the thing is, in my family, I probably didn't need to hide it at all. I think that because I wasn't fooling anybody, I don't think that they would have really had any sort of a problem with it. The outside world, yeah. But my mother was kind of one of those people that if you could buy a kit and how to make your child a homosexual, she would have bought that kit. Because it means your child's not going to be a juvenile delinquent, and that they're going to wind up, you know, probably, you know, spending some money on your Mother's Day present and be a good... I mean, if your son is gay, you don't really worry about him. Oh, you certainly don't worry about him, like, marrying a woman who you're not going to like, but you don't worry about him getting into trouble.
One of the stories in your new collection, Me Talk Pretty One Day, is about your earlier life before you were a writer as a conceptual artist and performance artist. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of that story.
Sure. The story is called 12 Moments in the Life of the Artist, and it's split into 12 different chapters. And this is the fifth chapter. 5. My sister Gretchen was leaving for the Rhode Island School of Design just as I was settling back into Raleigh. After a few months in my parents' basement, I took an apartment near the State University where I discovered both crystal methamphetamine and conceptual art. Either one of these things is dangerous, but in combination they have the potential to destroy entire civilizations. The moment I took my first burning snootful, I understood that this was a drug for me. Speed eliminates all doubt. Am I smart enough? Will people like me? Do I really look all right in this plastic jumpsuit? These are questions for insecure potheads. A speed enthusiast knows that everything he says or does is brilliant. The upswing is that, having eliminated the need for both eating and sleeping, you have a full 24 hours a day to spread your charm and talent. For God's sakes, my father would say, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. What are you calling for? I was calling because the rest of my friends had taken to unplugging their phones after 10 p.m. These were people I'd known in high school, and it disappointed me to see how little we now had in common. They were still talking about pen and ink portraits and couldn't understand my desire to drag a heavy cash register through the forest. I hadn't actually done it, but it sounded like a good idea to me. These people were all stuck in the past, setting up their booths in the art fair and thinking themselves successful because they'd sold a silk screen of a footprint in the sand. It was sad in a way. Here they were, struggling to make art, while without the least bit of effort, I was living art. My socks balled up on the hardwood floor made a greater statement than any of their hokey claptrap with the carefully matted frames and big curly signatures in the lower left-hand corners. Didn't they read any of the magazines? The new breed of artists wanted nothing to do with my sister's idea of beauty. Here were people who made a living pitching tents or lying in a fetal position before our national monuments. One fellow had made a name for himself by allowing a friend to shoot him in the shoulder. This was the art world I'd been dreaming of, where God-given talent was considered an unfair advantage, and a cold-blooded stare merited more praise than the ability to render human flesh. Everything around me was art, from the stains in my bathtub to the razor blade and short length of drinking straw I used to ingest and cut my speed. I was back in the world with a clear head and a keen vision of just how talented I really was.
David, is there a piece that you did during that period that you could describe for us?
You know, the thing is, my performance art was just so vacant and just so formulaic. Like, if I talk about plays that I've done, I can recall them because the plays had a story. But this was like the worst sort of performance art because it told no story whatsoever. It was all prop-driven. It was that sort of thing where you bring out like 15 objects and the audience just sits there and waits while you go through the rubber boot and while you go through the inflatable shark and while you go through the aspirin bottle filled with BBs. And the part of what made it so horrible was this notion that it was the audience's job to figure out the meaning. It wasn't your job. Your job was to just get up there with a sort of a slack expression on your face and, I don't know, cut your hair with garden shears. That was all you really needed to do. I did that for a couple of years, and I look back and, gee, I'm so embarrassed over some of the things that I did. And of course, I was just high as I could be the entire time, which convinced me that what I was doing was actually brilliant.
But as embarrassed as you are about the pieces that you did then, I bet there was something really liberating in a good way about your conceptual art and performance art period.
No, there was nothing liberating about it. It was just torment, and I just tortured everybody around me, and forcing my family to come and watch me in these horrible, horrible spectacles. And it wasn't really until I dropped out of college, and I was living in Raleigh when I discovered speed and conceptual art. And then I went back to school when I was 27. And then I was in art school, and I would watch people do these performances. And then I was able to really sort of clearly see for the first time just how unfun it is to sit in the audience, because it's all just about you being a performer. You don't really think about people in the audience. With a play, you think about people in the audience, and you think, are they going to get this story? Are they going to be bored? Are they going to walk out? And you sort of tailor what you're doing to those concerns. Whereas with performance art, you could just convince yourself that if people didn't get it, they were stupid. And you would think, well, who wouldn't want to watch me take a nap? who wouldn't want to see that?
So what was the actual turning point when you decided to give up your performance art?
When I ran out, my drug dealer moved to another state, and I did not have any speed left. And it was all I could do just to really to get out of bed. I've always been fond of drugs, but I don't think I'd ever been really hooked on anything before. And you don't really know you're hooked until you don't get your drugs anymore. And then you go through a withdrawal. And it was, I think, coming through the withdrawal from that, I thought, well, that part of my life is over. It's completely over, and it's time to try something new.
Is that when you started writing, or were you already writing?
I was already writing, and then I just sort of moved into that more or less full time, into the writing, rather than into the... Well, I went on to go to art school, but when I was in art school, it was mainly for painting and for sculpture, and I didn't do any performance art while I was in school.
How much talent did you have for, say, representational painting and sculpture?
I have no talent whatsoever. No talent whatsoever. If I was a courtroom sketch artist, it would look like drawings of a five-year-old. All the characters would have really big heads, and they would either smile or frown. It would be like those drawings that children do after they've been abused or whatever, with the angry mommy or the happy mommy. They would be drawings like that. I can't draw anything.
My guest is David Sedaris. His book, Me Talk Pretty One Day, has just come out in paperback. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is humorist David Sedaris. His book, Me Talk Pretty One Day, has just come out in paperback. Why did you want to be an artist if you felt you had so little talent for it?
I wanted to be an artist just from when I was young and reading books and biographies, and I had the idea that you would be an artist and it would just be very romantic, and you would live in a garret and you would have a closet full of berets. And it was enough to keep me going until the age of 28, this romantic notion.
So what you wanted was the artist's life, maybe more so than the art itself?
I wanted the artist's life, and I wanted to live in a studio and filled with naked men, you know, who would be posing for me while I would chisel them out of marble. And then I saw myself, like, wearing long scarves and going to museum openings. But I just could never see the work itself. That was a problem.
So when you took writing more seriously and gave up painting and sculpture and performance art, did you fashion a kind of artist life for yourself as a writer? Did you see the possibilities for that?
No, strangely, I never did. But with writing, I would just notice how, when I was doing artwork, how I could look at something and walk away from it and just forget it. Whereas there would be certain stories that I would read that I would be haunted by, and I would read them over and over and over again until I memorized them. And I just noticed that the words had power over me, whereas visual art genuinely didn't. I think I just got into it because nothing else worked. I tried being an actor. I was horrible. I tried performance art. I stunk. I tried visual art. I was terrible. I'm just lucky I found writing before I went through a dance phase.
The funny thing is, though, that there is a whole romance around writing, just as there is a whole romance around the life of the visual artist. And I'm surprised kind of that you didn't hook into that romanticized vision of the writer.
No, I guess because I've always read a lot of biographies, and you always just read about writers wind up, you know, they wind up being really drunk and calling their friends until their friends don't answer the phone. Like Jean Stafford, she was one of those writers who wound up just a mess, and her last project, she had an idea for a book called Cooking for One While Drunk. So I never thought of a rosy ending to a writing life.
Uh-huh. Now, you said that crystal methamphetamine was your drug of choice because it was so good at eliminating doubts and make you feeling really confident and good about yourself and your work. What were some of the doubts you needed to eliminate that were very inhibiting for you?
That I had no talent whatsoever, and that what I was doing was absolutely meaningless, and that everybody was laughing at me instead of admiring me because I came up with these great things that they couldn't understand. Speed pretty much eliminates any doubt that you would have. You know, you look like a million bucks. You're incredibly bright. I look back at my diary during that time, and I would easily write 10 pages a night. And it's just awful, just awful. There's not a single sentence in there worth salvaging. And then that's what I wrote down, when I think what came out of my mouth was probably even worse.
When you stopped taking speed, did the old doubts come back, the doubts that you were suppressing with the speed?
Oh, yes, they came back. Oh, they came back immediately, only stronger.
Well, how did you deal with those doubts in your writing?
With the writing, it seems much easier to deal with those doubts because you can confront them honestly. And also, you're telling a story. I don't know, there was something about that whole period where narrative was bad. Narrative was a bad thing. To tell people a story was cheap and easy.
So it was just... Like, when you started writing, was there a kind of experimental fiction that was the equivalent of performance art?
Yes, but I noticed I never read those things.
Right.
And I didn't feel any... You know, like sometimes you're young and you go through a certain phase and you pretend to like these things that you can't bear. You pretend to like these movies that are just... In fact, they're just a bore, but you think that if you say that they're boring, then everyone's going to think you're stupid. But I noticed that I would never subject myself to reading things that didn't have the story, that didn't satisfy me. And I felt okay in saying, that's not for me. And so luckily I never went through that phase.
So the doubts that came back after you stopped the crystal meth and started writing. It sounds like those are doubts that you were able to incorporate into the writing, that you were in part writing about the doubts, so you could describe them instead of suppressing them?
Yes, and they were very helpful that way. Because really, that's basically all I have to talk about, is my doubts. And denied that, gee, you just pour styrofoam pellets into a rubber boot and empty them into a pail and call it a night.
You're living in France. How long have you been there?
I've been there for almost 2 years.
Uh-huh. And what brought you to France? Why did you leave New York?
Smoking. You can smoke wherever you want to in France. And it's heaven that way. All those European countries, they should just represent them on maps with big ashtrays. I recorded a book on tape in New York, my last book. I recorded it on tape here, and you had to leave the building. You had to go down 8 floors in order to have a cigarette. And I recorded the new book on tape in Paris, and there were 2 standing ashtrays right in the recording booth, which was the size of a closet.
What's it like for you, who is so verbal and so defined by your language, to function in a country where you can't do what most defines you, which is speak? I mean, I think your French is probably still fairly rudimentary. And so it's hard, I'm sure, for you to communicate with a lot of the people there.
That's my incentive, though, to learn, because, you know, it drives me crazy to sit there and have to keep my mouth shut. It drives me absolutely out of my mind. So that's been my biggest incentive to learn. But it's hard, you know, we'll go to dinner sometimes, and he speaks French perfectly, and he's got a lot of French friends, and we'll go to dinner at their house, and at one end of the table, everybody is laughing and engaging in sparkling conversation. And I just see the guests at my end of the table saying, I had to sit next to him the last time. Everyone on the other side of the table, they're having a ball, and on my end of the table, it's me saying, I saw a rabbit in the road yesterday, and he was happy. That's what I have to bring to the table. I talk like Yoda, basically. And now my verbs are, I'm getting my verbs down. And that makes it a lot easier, because you can't, some exhaust people a little bit less than I did before. I just try to be the most cheerful person in the country. That's how I go about it.
Well, David Sedaris, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Sedaris recorded last year. His book, Me Talk Pretty One Day, has just come out in paperback. The book is being adapted into a film by director Wayne Wong. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Alan Cumming. He co-wrote and co-directed the new film The Anniversary Party with his co-star Jennifer Jason Leigh. And Henry Sheehan reviews the new film Swordfish, starring John Travolta. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even when he's in a small role, I find it impossible to take my eyes off Alan Cumming when he's on the screen. He's not handsome in the typical pumped-up movie star kind of way, but he has a very expressive face that can be goofy or menacing, attractive or geeky. In the film Eyes Wide Shut, he stole the scene as a hotel clerk flirting with Tom Cruise. In the Bond film Goldeneye, he was an evil computer nerd. His other films include Urbania, Get Carter, Viva Rock Vegas, Circle of Friends, and Emma. Cumming wrote and directed the new film The Anniversary Party with his co-star Jennifer Jason Leigh. Cumming plays a British writer who's moved to Hollywood, where his novel, inspired by his troubled marriage, is being made into a film. He and his wife Sally, played by Leigh, are throwing a party to celebrate their 6th anniversary. Here's a scene from the party in which Cumming is talking to a neighbor he's invited in the hopes of smoothing over a feud about his and Sally's barking dog.
See, you've moved up from the soft stuff.
Oh, yeah. You know, Ryan's been sober for 8 years, so it's difficult if I, it's better if I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little nervous, so yeah, a little out of my element, yeah.
No, you're not.
Well, yes. Yes, in fact, I am. A little on the outside, yeah. And there's been all of this friction.
Mm.
These misunderstandings have a way of escalating.
Very well put.
You know, I think a lot of this could have been avoided if Sally had made more of an effort.
What?
But you're very private people. You know, there's a sort of, there's a kind of elitism.
Elitism? That...
Wrong word, maybe? Delete that. And, you know, the dog barks incessantly.
And you know who really does not?
And Ryan works at home.
And your phone calls are nasty and abusive, and I've come this close to suing you for harassment, and the only reason you are here is because we're supposed to be sucking up to you.
On screen and stage, Alan Cumming has a very expressive body, which he used to great effect dancing in the Broadway revival of Cabaret. He played the MC, the role originated by Joel Grey. Cumming created a more sexed-up version of the character, and it was a sensation on Broadway. We spoke last year.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Fremda, étranger, stranger. Glücklich zu sehen, je suis enchanté. Happy to see you, bleibe, reste, stay. Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. In cabaret, au cabaret, to cabaret. Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies and Gentlemen. Guten Abend, bonsoir, good evening. Wie geht's? Comment ça va? Do you feel good?
Yeah, I bet you do.
Ich bin euer Conferencia, je suis votre compère. I am your host. Und sage, willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. Im Cabaret, au Cabaret, tout Cabaret. Leave your troubles outside. So...
That's Alan Cumming in the cast recording of the revival of Cabaret. Now, this production of Cabaret was directed by Sam Mendes, who also directed the movie American Beauty. Your version of this character, the MC, was much more sexual than the Joel Grey version, which was, he did the original on Broadway, he did the movie. Whose idea was it to make the character that sexual?
It was kind of a combination. When we did it in London, first of all, Sam directed it there. And then when we came to New York, Sam and Rob Marshall directed it together. And all, so it was kind of grew on this journey from London. But really, I remember saying to him, you know, I wasn't really mad about doing the show at all. I didn't think it was really my bag. And if I was going to do it, I wanted to do it sort of properly and kind of like make the character a real person from that time. You know, I was really fascinated by that time. And I had... read the Isherwood books and everything, and so I knew that there was much more kind of debauched and decadent, truly decadent, than actually has ever really been portrayed. And so the character in that kind of club, which is basically, you know, a sort of glorified sex club, I just felt would have more of a kind of a, would have more of the gutter about him. And in a way, he's the club saved him. If it weren't for the fact that he got this job in the club, he would be, you know, on the streets and would, or, you know, would be dead or by now. So, which was much more kind of realistic for that time and for that area of Berlin in that time. So that's why this whole sort of sex thing came about, because I wanted to make it more realistic. And then, of course, when we started to work on it in both London and New York, more so in New York, I think, the sort of sexuality and the kind of mischievousness of the sexuality became part of the whole, his act to the audience. And then it kind of went from there, really.
What did you wear?
Not very much. a variety of very slinky things. I wore the thing that everyone saw and sort of balked at, was kind of like little, if you imagine little trousers that are cut off at the knee, and then kind of big boots, and then that was basically it. And then kind of I sort of, it was like, you know, suspenders that men wear on their trousers to hold them up, kind of a selection of those in a kind of round my crotch and up my back and round my tummy, no, round my chest. But it's kind of weird to describe it. And basically a lot of body makeup with track marks and glittery nipples. And so basically nothing on my body apart from a pair of trousers and a little bit of suspender, which kind of, there was this kind of joke about, like, I had the Wonder Bra for the crotch because of the suspender thing. It kind of, everything was lifted. And because I had to dance, everything was kind of lifted up and forward into a very pleasing, you know, array downstairs, if you see what I mean.
Now, did you get a lot of reaction from men and women?
Yeah, it was pretty across the board. I think it's really fascinating because a lot of people who weren't like your normal sort of fan or your normal kind of person who would get all wobbly-kneed did get wobbly-kneed because this character was so sort of, it kind of got under their skin, and it was so, it was like a little boy thing in a way. It was like, you knew... It was like a little devil, a little kind of devil, but you knew you'd have a great time. And it kind of stirred people up in some very primal way that they're not used to being stirred up in. And also, I think, you know, I'm not like, you know, the conventional view of a sexy man is not me. It's not, or what we're sold as and told to be thought of as sexy is not me. So I think there was something about that as well. There was kind of, it seems in a way more safe and yet at the same time more dangerous to have some sort of skinny boy who is, you know, stirring you in your loins in some way. and so people would, you know, it's really fascinating. I mean, also extremely scary for me, but fascinating that people would say, you know, I've never, like a married man would say, I've never had any sexual feelings for a man before, but I was very stirred up by you, and it made me really think weird things. And then, you know, women who would say things in front of their husbands, and, you know, it was really quite extraordinary.
Well, how do you respond, like, if a man comes up to you and says, I've never felt sexually aroused by a man before, but watching you dance, etc., what do you say? Thank you very much, and move on to the next fan?
Yeah, you sort of go, oh, that's lovely. Good for you. Or, you know, maybe you should get out more. Things like that.
Now, one of the roles that you brought, I mean, of all things, a role that you brought this sexually insinuating energy into was Annie, the TV production of Annie. And there's a great number, Easy Street. It's a duet you did with Kathy Bates in this
and production. And Kristen Chenoweth is in it, too.
Right, okay.
It's a trio.
Yes. Yeah. And you're doing this kind of bump and grind thing.
Yeah.
To this. And your dancing and singing was terrific in it. So why don't you talk about this number a little bit and then we'll hear it.
Oh, well, this was Rob Marshall, who choreographed Cabaret and who co-directed it with Sam. He directed this. And I'd never seen Annie. I didn't know the story or anything. And so I just did it because of him. I just thought I would have a good time. I just thought he is great. And so... The best thing about him is that he makes you feel confident about things that you're not actually very good at, which is a great skill as a director. And Kathy said that the same thing, you know. I don't think she'd done a musical before, and I'd never done a musical like this before, like playing an American person and you know, and doing all that kind of like proper and musical sort of thing. So this was, and also had, like there was like about a 12-page dance break in it, and none of us, Kristen had danced more than Cathy and I, but it was one of these things that was actually such fun to do, and I'm so glad I took part in it. And it's this song. This song is like when she runs the orphanage, Cathy, and I'm called Rooster, and me and my girlfriend, I've escaped from prison, and we come and we're trying to sort out some scheme to make money, and we realise that Annie is, could be the key to this scheme.
Let's hear Easy Street.
I remember the way our sainted mother would sit and croon us our lullaby. She'd say, kids, there's a place that's like no other. You gotta get there before you die.
You don't get there by playing from the rule book.
Uh-uh, you stack the aces.
Mm-hmm, you load the dice.
Mother dear, oh, we know you're down there listening. How can we follow your sweet advice to
Easy Street, Easy Street, where you sleep till noon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She'd repeat, Easy Street, better get there soon.
So, sis, who was the hot tomato in the... It's from the TV production of Annie. My guest is Alan Cumming. So I find it interesting that you hadn't really sung and danced before Cabaret and Annie. What did you have to learn in order to pull these roles off?
Well, you know, it's kind of, I mean, I'm not a proper singer. I'm not like a big proper, well, you know, like a how you imagine a Broadway or that type of singer. I'm not that, and I'm never going to be that. I don't want to be that. So I actually didn't really, you know, things like breathing and blah, 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 you have to kind of get better at. And I hadn't actually done much theatre for a while. I'd done a lot of films in between doing Cabaret in London and Cabaret in New York. So I had to get in shape again. But really, it's the same. I just think of it as the same thing. You know, you're just sort of acting, but you're just like singing. The singing, in a way, in Cabaret, it was easier because my character, part of his job in the role was that he sang songs in a club, so that was fine. In Annie, that was the first time I'd done that thing where you like are talking and then you burst into song. Which I've always had a problem with. But it seemed easier because it was more sort of fun, and the style of it, I got into the sort of heightened style of... It's about understanding the style and about understanding your role within the thing. Basically, the same sort of rules that you would hope you would use for any part, whether you'd sing or not. But the dancing was hard. I mean, I hurt myself doing Annie, actually.
What happened?
Well, there's this bit when we danced down the street, and then I did a thing where I jumped up and down, and it was concrete. I was jumping up and down, and it was a big crane shot, so I had to do it a lot of times. And I injured my groin, if you must know. But it's better now.
This is penance for your role in Cabaret.
Yeah, I know. I did all that and didn't get any injuries, really. But, yeah, there's a lot of... That must be the groin karma.
My guest is Alan Cumming. He and Jennifer Jason Leigh wrote, directed, and star in the new film, The Anniversary Party. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Alan Cumming. Now, you studied at the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama. Mm-hmm. What kind of roles were you given as a student? What kind of type were you perceived as?
Well, it's always weird when you're a student because, you know, you have to play, you do plays, grown-up plays that are for people who are like 40 and stuff, and you're like 19. So it's kind of a misconception of you're normally misconceived because you're actually, you know, like decades too young. But I think I was sort of you know, the young juve sort of person, and that's not really happened since I left. I think I was more kind of young and spunky and nice. I was a nice boy. That was the sort of kind of roles I got. And actually, when I left drama school for a while, I looked very young for my age. And so that was, you know, that affected the parts I got. And when I started to do things out professionally, I would always be playing, like, you know, in TV shows, like the little boy who's running away from the police and stuff like that, and who's being wrongly done to and getting, you know, drowned. I was always being drowned for a while. And then I started to get to play more nasty people. I don't know, something happened to me.
Did something happen to you, or just... It was...
I don't know. I must have. I don't know. But I think. I mean, I started. I would. For there was a sort of transition phase where I would get these kind of like baby face nasty people. I remember I did this soap opera in Scotland, and I played like this evil woodcutter for a while, and then so I was like a nice boy ostensibly, but I had, you know, a heart of darkness, and then shortly after that I started to. I don't know. I suppose it's kind of. I suppose if you're told you're a nice boy, you're like a little sweet cutie boy, for so long, you kind of want to bring some other edge to it so that people. I remember actually thinking, oh, I've not thought about this before, but I remember thinking, oh, I wish I was more interesting. I wish I wasn't just like, you know, looked like such a baby when I first started acting. And so maybe I tried to bring other colours into my work so that I wouldn't have to play boring people all the time.
Huh. Well, you know, I think a more contemporary version of that kind of nice and mean mixture is in the James Bond movie that you did, GoldenEye. Because on the one hand, you're playing like a computer nerd, but you're pretty evil.
Yeah, I know. I get people killed and everything, and I'm involved in this plot to take over the world.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But you're not, you know, you're not like...
But I'm nice.
Physically menacing person.
No, he's like wears little shorts and he's got specs. And specky people are never too scary.
I think one of your first breaks was in a Lee Jeans commercial. Is that right?
I did do a Lee Jeans commercial. I wouldn't consider it one of my first breaks, but it was a financial break. Yeah, it was when I was doing a lot of theatre in London, and I got this, bizarrely, I can't remember how it came about, but all of a sudden I was the Lee Jeans boy in America for a while, and did this commercial for them, you know, shot it in London and never saw it, except someone once sent me a tape of it when it was on TV in America. And it was one, I was like the Lee Jeans relaxed fit boy. So I thought, it kind of sounds sexy when you're the Lee Jeans boy. When you say you're the relaxed fit boy, it's like saying you're the cardigan wearing Lee Jeans boy, or the comfy cosy one that mum will like. So, but that's who I was, yeah. I did that. That was funny.
How were you posed in it?
Well, I was like, it was a TV commercial, so I was driving in my car. It's sort of a 50s kind of feel. And there was a girl who was in the house and she was like struggling to get her tight jeans on. And there was a mannequin on the car. And I come out and I've got flowers for her and I'm all like doing my hair in the mirror. And I look up to the window and I see her. She bumps into the mannequin trying to put her jeans on. And I think she's like falling on the bed with another boy. And I look at the camera and the little thing of flowers all kind of deflates and flops. And I look sad.
That's funny.
And of course, then there's a shot of my bum with the Lee Jeans relaxed fit on. If only she had been like me and worn the relaxed fit jeans, we'd still be together.
No, you went from Scotland to England and worked on the London stage.
Yes.
Was your Scottish accent considered a problem?
I think it was, you know. I still find it weird. Like today, I was just talking. The Royal Scottish Academy where I went has this mentoring program, and I was just talking to the little student who I am mentoring today, and he's from Glasgow, and we were talking about accents and stuff, and he said, "Oh, you haven't lost your accent," and I went, "Well, I would hope not, because you know I think you lose your accent, you lose your personality. It's really important for me that I sound the sum of my life. Do you know what I mean?"
Mm-hmm.
But it's less. And now, obviously, now that I get to do films in American accents or English accents or funny Irish ones, it's not a problem. but that's because I'm more well-known and people let you. But when I first started, yeah, it was definitely a thing. People would ask me to go to auditions and pretend not to be Scottish because they said, you know you can do it. And I would go, yes, I know I can do it, but I won't be me in the meeting. And surely, I mean, I've always thought the most important thing about any actor is the person. And the more you can let of the person through, the more successful you are about, and the more interesting you'll be to people. That is more interesting than technique.
Alan Cumming recorded last year. He and Jennifer Jason Leigh wrote, directed, and star in the new film, The Anniversary Party. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie Swordfish, starring John Travolta. This is Fresh Air. The new summer action film Swordfish stars John Travolta as a renegade secret agent out to steal from government bank accounts in order to finance a personal war against terrorism. Helping him out is a computer hacker played by Hugh Jackman, who was Wolverine in last summer's X-Men, and Halle Berry, who played Storm in X-Men. Berry appears topless in one Swordfish scene in what our film critic Henry Sheehan assumes is an attempt to attract a young male audience. Here's Henry's review.
For years, Hollywood has been claiming, to itself as much as to anyone else, that it makes the best action movies in the world. This is demonstrably false, and laughably so to anyone who has been watching Hong Kong action movies for the last 15 years. Now even the broader American public knows just how phony the claim is after the unbridled commercial success of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was only a fair example of Asian expertise. To prove their dubious point, Hollywood executives invariably point to how much money these movies make, both in America and abroad. This week's Exhibit A is Swordfish, the saga of a rogue spy who plans to rob the government of some secret bank accounts, both through computer trickery and brute force. This corrupted 007 is played by John Travolta, who seemed to enjoy making a comeback so much that he's been doing everything in his power to make another one necessary. Here, as Maverick spy Gabriel Scheer, he explains the foundations of his evil plans to hero Stanley Jobson, played by up-and-comer Hugh Jackman. Once a co-conspirator, Stanley has blanched at the violence of Gabriel's plan.
You ask who those men were. I'm going to tell you.
I don't care about any of this. All I care about is my daughter.
I'm talking about your daughter. I'm talking about you and your daughter and 200 million other Americans who take their freedoms for granted. You don't understand what it takes to protect those freedoms. That's my job, Stanley.
So you and your band of lunatics are really stealing all this money just to protect little old me.
That's right, Stanley. Because wars cost money.
War? Who are we at war with?
Anyone who impinges on America's freedom, someone must bring their war to them. We've been doing this stuff for years. Our job is to make terrorism so horrific that it becomes unthinkable to attack Americans.
You're not going in over the phone lines. You're going into the bank.
And you're coming with us. In the end, you'll have done your small part in ensuring America's way of life. You're a hero, Stan.
I don't know. It just strikes me that detailing your plans in a sing-song rhythm isn't the way to strike fear into the heart of either your foe or your audience. This cluelessness permeates the entire movie. The filmmakers, led by Dominic Sena, who, like most of the current crop of action directors, is a former commercial and music video director, are so morally obtuse that they don't even know whom it's okay to kill off. The movie begins with a bravura special effects scene incorporating many of the stop-motion computer imaging gimmicks of The Matrix. But rather than base the scene on the death of a bad guy or the usual sacrificial good guy second banana, the filmmakers begin the fireworks by blowing up a terrified hostage, a young woman who spends her last moments on screen begging and pleading to live. Hot damn, what a blast. More grotesquely for a self-anointed action film, there are only a niggling few big action scenes in the whole movie. Filmmakers have turned to more and more extravagantly computerized effects as their ability to stage and edit a normal action scene has diminished. Remember last summer's Gone in 60 Seconds? It featured a car chase that would have been booed off the screen 20 years ago. So Sena and his crew go almost exclusively with optical and computer tricks. The one natural effect is Halle Berry's topless scene. Playing Gabriel's girl Friday, she decides to have a talk with Stanley in the middle of sunbathing. Anyway, computer gimmickry is expensive, so the filmmakers are forced to limit how much action they can put on screen. The opening action bit is in fact a flash forward to the climax, which by the time we get to it after endless servings of Travolta ham, is quickly replayed and then adorned with a grandiosely awful chase scene. What's really irksome about all this is the implication that the action audience is so docile and dumb that they'll pay up to see trash like this no matter how much it stinks. Action fans of the world unite. Stay home and rent a good Hong Kong flick like City on Fire instead.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Jerry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Division, publisher of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates, a novel by Tom Robbins, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an atlas of depression. We talk with Andrew Solomon. His new book, The Noonday Demon, is about his breakdowns and also examines the biology of depression, pharmaceutical antidepressants, and how depression is treated in different cultures. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.